Hi, folks. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole in conversation with Bill Smaldone, a historian specializing in modern Germany and Europe. Starting with the First and Second World Wars, as countries maneuvered and fought one another for position, he writes a lot, carefully watches current struggles. Last week, we recorded a discussion on the very serious period we have entered. It seems on a trajectory to human self-extinction, testing whether we can live peacefully and sustainably on this planet. Those existential struggles, including the war with nature as the major countries of the world fail to deal with global warming, and the human extinction could also result in several very dangerous struggles that could escalate the nuclear war in Ukraine, and also the maneuvers of U.S. and Chinese militaries in the South China Sea. One of the key factors in these military struggles is the U.S., our drive for military and political supremacy across the planet. Here are some excerpts from that conversation.
Especially in terms of American imperial interests in Asia, coming into conflict with Chinese imperial interests as China becomes a greater and greater regional and global player. And I think one of the great hypocrisies that we see in American foreign policy is our insistence, you know, on basically keeping the boot of our power on the neck, right, of the Cuban people, the Cuban economy, which is a very small economy and has no real impact on the United States and is easy to push around. But we don't do anything to the Chinese state, right, along those lines, because China is big and strong and is not easy to push around. So you see some of the contradictions of American policy clearly, right, in terms of our relations with China.
My sense is that U.S. hypocrisy, it's astounding that they get away with it. Our leaders think it's just a fact of nature that the U.S. operates according to the self-proclaimed Monroe Doctrine, asserting that the U.S. can interfere in the government of any country south of the border. And our elites do it without apology, just throw out one government and put in one that doesn't threaten to nationalize U.S. interest or raise taxes. But for Russia and China, both encircled by some of the 700 U.S. military bases around the world, encircled near them, that they threaten countries on their border, adjacent countries, and demand neutrality and non-acceptance of U.S. military bases with missiles. That's trumpeted by U.S. as a violation of international law.
I'd like to come back to the theme of Eastern Europe for a moment and connect it with Russia and China's recent close relations. And so one of the things that needs to be pointed out, I think, is that in recent years, the decision made since 1990 by Western policymakers to expand NATO into Eastern Europe and to do that parallel with the expansion of the military alliance is often portrayed as a kind of an almost natural necessity, right? That NATO was needed to protect Eastern Europe from the aggressive Russian state in the East. And I would argue that that is a rather myopic view of recent Eastern European history, because if you read works by people like a historian at Princeton named Sorota, right, who published recently a book called Not One Inch, she documents quite well how the United States and its allies had a choice in the 1990s. It could have constructed a new security system that could link the whole Eurasian area, right, including Russia, together in a security system of equals in which Russia would be a full partner. At that time, the Soviet Union had collapsed. Russia, the successor state to the Soviet Union, was basically on its knees, both economically and militarily, and it was experiencing a very chaotic and contradictory transition away from the Soviet-style dictatorship that had existed before toward a more democratic order, right? There was democratic potential in Russia at that time. But rather than really build upon that potential and encourage democratic reform in Russia, and rather than create a Eurasian-wide security system to replace the old NATO-Warsaw Pact dichotomy, instead of doing that, the United States backed, on the one hand, the creation of a powerful presidency in the new Russian polity, one that basically relegated parliament to secondary status and elevated the power of the president, because at that time, the president, Yeltsin, was essentially one of our puppets, one might say, in Russian politics. Yeltsin was willing to play ball with the United States, so we figured whatever strengthened his hand would be good for us. But ultimately, Yeltsin was replaced by Putin, who is a totally different animal than Yeltsin, and he has used the strength of the executive in the Russian political system essentially to destroy any of the democratic structures that were being formed in the 1990s and to impose what is a kind of new autocracy in Russia. So that policy by the United States led to the opposite of what the United States claimed that it wanted, which was a more democratic Russia. Also, by promoting NATO in Eastern Europe, it once again basically restored the dichotomy of the Cold War. You have the so-called democratic West, okay, but now the line of demarcation is deep into Eastern Europe. It's no longer in Central Europe, but it's in Eastern Europe. It runs along the line of the Baltic states, Poland, and Ukraine. And Ukraine was one of the last states not to belong to NATO. And the choice in recent years has been to determine whether or not Ukraine was going to be neutral, like a state like Finland, say, between Russia and its allies and the Western allies, or was Ukraine going to be absorbed into one or the other of the two blocs? And so I think one has to be very clear that it is Russia that is the aggressor in this war, and Russia has to be condemned, and it is my hope that it will be defeated. But at the same time, the standoff or the conflict between the West in the form of NATO and the EU, right, and Russia, which is allied with a number of former Soviet satellite states like Kazakhstan and so on in that region, that standoff didn't have to take place. There could have been a different order in Eastern Europe, but we elected not to go down that road. This has pushed Russia closer to China because Russia was increasingly isolated from the West politically, and the Chinese, who have developed a very powerful economy, and the Russians have some joint interests, right, in pooling their strengths, right, against their rivals from Western Europe and North America. And that's what they're doing in the current constellation, right? In my view, that's the underlying cement that holds those two states together.
You just heard me, Bill Resnick, for the Old Mole on cable radio, talking with Bill Smaldone, a historian of modern history, critiquing the U.S. drive for world supremacy, also attacking the Russian and Chinese elites for the oppressive regimes they've established. Coming up are excerpts from our discussion. That both the Ukraine war and the U.S.-China rivalry, they have no solution if U.S. elites remain committed to U.S. supremacy. So, Bill, it seems to me that China supported the invasion of Ukraine because they wanted to have demonstrated what can happen if the U.S. refuses to accept the Chinese takeover of Taiwan, that the Chinese consider part of China's historic territory. China is not going to back down. They will not accept U.S. supremacy, domination of every inch on Earth. Over the long run, this struggle will become extremely serious. China will accept nothing less than achieving equality with the U.S. China wants to be recognized as a world power, second to none. And China has set up a whole alternative trade system, investment system, international transaction system. It rivals the U.S. system of the IMF, the World Bank, and the U.S. international transaction structure called the SWIFT system. There's going to be many very difficult years ahead if this country remains committed to military and political supremacy on the lands, the water, and space.
First of all, you are correct in that not only do we have this explosive crisis in Eastern Europe, a war that could easily become a regional war, that could expand, right, that could draw in the United States, and that could ultimately result in a nuclear confrontation. That would, of course, be the most catastrophic result. That would be a disaster that we don't really want to contemplate, but it is a possibility. So not only do we have that situation, but we have this standoff between China and the United States over Taiwan. There are many other outstanding issues between the United States and China, for example, the Chinese policy concerning the Uyghurs and the expansion in the South Pacific that you described. Now, I would assert that there are interests in the United States that wish to gin up this standoff, that are not shying away from the possibility of war. And this is well explained in a recent article in Monthly Review, in the May issue of Monthly Review, by Lawrence Shoup, who wrote a book about current war planning with China. He wrote an article about current war planning. There's a new book by a guy named Eldridge Colby, who is a close partner with the Council on Foreign Relations. And he has published a book in which he sort of outlines the necessity for, you know, wartime preparations against China. And this is very serious, I think. If people in the Council of Foreign Relations are contemplating a war between China and the United States, that's serious business because that group is extraordinarily influential in the formation of American state policy. So what we see here are two places right now in which the United States is hovering around the possibility of war, right, that could easily escalate into some kind of nuclear confrontation. The idea, as some American strategists are proposing, of fighting a kind of limited non-nuclear war with China, one that would be fought out on the Chinese mainland, right, to protect Taiwan, this is to me rank insanity, but it is being contemplated by some decision makers in Washington.
Hi, folks. Again, this is Bill Resnick in conversation with Bill Smaldone, historian, specialist in world systems, particularly modern Europe. We've been discussing the great threats to humanity and the potentials for human extinction in today's world. These include wars, including the well-covered Ukraine war and the hardly known shadow war in the South China Sea, with the U.S. committed to put down China's challenge to the U.S. And military planners in all the involved wars are considering the use and defense from nuclear weapons. Needless to say, shooting wars tend to escalate. Of course, there exists another deadly threat, that the capitalist world system is on its way to destroying the ecosystems, particularly the climate system upon which life depends. And we conclude this interview discussing the environmental threat, but also reasons for hope that we could end wars and stop global warming, because ironically, responding to the climate threat could well reduce the resort to war among the nations. That's because as climate disasters become more frequent, dangerous, costly, and deadly, people around the world, including here, are waking up to the threat. They're increasingly demanding action, demanding that the U.S. and China take the lead in the international mobilization that climate science has deemed necessary. And the vast international cooperative efforts that are required to reconstruct the world economy, this mobilization might well interrupt the wars and preparation for wars. This does not mean abandoning the peace movement. It must be strengthened. But what this does mean is that all our movements must link up to climate action struggles. Indeed, we all need force, the many nations, to force that vision of international cooperation to transform the world economy and how we produce and consume. In any event, in our efforts to offer reasons for hope that humanity can survive, Bill Smaldone, tell us about Germany and Europe. They are now achieving some success in reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
Right. So I would say that in many ways, the German turn toward a non-fossil fuel energy policy was driven, on the one hand, by growing awareness, growing consciousness, right, of the extent of the environmental catastrophe that we now face. And not just the warming climate, but also what people are calling, you know, the sixth extinction, that the environmental crisis is more than just about warming. It's about many things. So you have this growing environmental consciousness in Germany and other countries in Europe. And then with the nuclear disaster in Japan a few years ago, it was the center-right government who announced that Germany would move out of the nuclear energy market. It would no longer build nuclear plants, and it was going to move quickly away from nuclear energy into renewables. And so, if you're not doing coal, you're not doing oil, you're not going to do nuclear, this means you're forced to do solar and wind. And that's where the Germans have made huge strides. And anybody who's been visiting Germany in the past 3 decades knows that there has arisen all over the country a forest of wind energy installations. They're everywhere, and there are more and more of them being put up all the time. Also, there's been a huge expansion in solar energy, and we now have at the national level a coalition that, even before the Ukraine crisis peaked, was committed to bringing about what's called the energy turn. Germany is a rich country. It can direct huge resources into alternative energy sectors. And the Greens want to do that. The Social Democrats want to do that. They want to do it at the local level. They want to encourage local initiative, but they also know that large-scale state infrastructural investments will be necessary. So if that can happen in Germany, right, in the course of, say, 35 years, I think it's very possible that you could have similar sea changes in attitudes across the world. I think those changes can also be telescoped, right? They can occur a lot faster. They will have to occur a lot faster because the situation is in many ways so grim. But for me, that German history, that recent German history, is in many ways a hopeful history that might portend similar kinds of progress elsewhere.
So, Bill, your point that Germany is doing it reinforces a crucial point, that humanity has all the technologies and human skills and resources to do it quickly. Of course, humanity might be on the road to oblivion, but only because the planet's economic and political elites will not accept a solution that would undermine their power and wealth. But they're not omnipotent. So, Bill Smaldone, in this ghastly, changing, and threatened world, you have done what we asked of you. provide some substantial hope and what to work for. So thanks for talking today.
I'm always happy to help the comrades at Old Mole. Thanks for having me on.